Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we've been discussing some fundamental issues in theology. I was dissatisfied with my broadcast last week. I tried to do too much in too short a space. There's so much information here, and worse than that, there's so much disinformation. There's so much poor thinking, a lack of critical judgment in this most critical of areas that is overwhelming sometimes. And so if you wouldn't mind, I would like to clarify some of the things I said last week when it came to basic theology and interpretation. There's always been this tension, so-called, between faith and reason, assuming that the two entities really have no common ground. That's really a postmodern notion. The point is to make faith seem unreasonable. Religious faith in postmodern America is something that's just based on blind credulity, rather than, an ethnic or a cultural ornament. But of course, that's false. That distinction, it's a false dichotomy, and the same Athens versus Jerusalem nonsense, monastic versus humanist. The two concepts are tightly bound together. They're one and the same, at least in the sense that they use the same metaphysical foundations. The secular bias is that reason accepts what is empirically verifiable, while faith is just almost a childish credulity. Yet, of course, empiricism has to assume, on faith, the existence of matter, pre-existing natural order, the accuracy of the senses, the ability of logical categories to line up with what we sense external to us, and the reliability of reason and inference itself. But this faith versus reason distinction is completely false, and even the most cursory scan of the fathers will put this dichotomy to rest. And of course, the concept of faith never meant any kind of credulity without a rational foundation. That's a 20th century vulgarization. The question as to what reason contributes to the faith is absurd. The truth is that faith is a manifestation of God as reason or wisdom, logos. Reason has a divine foundation. Anything else makes it arbitrary. St. Clement of Alexandria, one of the apostolic fathers, who died in 215 AD, he writes this in Book 2 of the Stromata. And not only the Platonists, but the Stoics say that assent is on our own power. All opinion, then, in judgment, in supposition, and knowledge by which we live and have perpetual intercourse with the human race is an assent, which is nothing else than faith. And unbelief, being defection from faith, shows both assent and faith to be possessed of power. For non-existence cannot be called privation. If you consider the truth, you'll find man naturally misled so as to give assent to what is false, though possessing the resources necessary to believe in the truth. The virtue, then, that encloses the church in its grasp, as the shepherd says, is faith, by which the elect of God are saved. And that which acts, the man is self-restraint. And these are followed by simplicity, knowledge, innocence, decorum, and love. And all of these are daughters of faith. And again, faith leads the way, fear upbuilds, and love perfects. Now, the postmodern mind can't make any sense out of that. All empirical verification requires faith. Yet the human mind constantly strives for and assumes an unchanging foundation. It is not satisfied with empiricism. It's very common to hear the concept of faith defined as something other than rational knowledge. One has faith in somebody because they're sure, but not certain, they'll act in a certain way. Using it that way, faith is defined as assent to the truth because the sources of that truth are worthy to be heeded, trustworthy. We can say the same about our senses, our own rational faculty, which sometimes can just be nothing more than just mere logic. We know the truth, but we only believe in it because we want to. Truth doesn't contain the will to follow it. Most men in this mass society have no concern for truth, only self-interest. And even then, they err. There are many reasons to reject the truth if one's lifestyle will be radically altered by it. And of course, I've said this many times. I've told this story before, and I'll say it again. When I started, after my master's program, and I started my doctoral program at Nebraska, thanks to a Warren Buffett fellowship, in January of 95, I wasn't happy with mere empirical knowledge. I needed to find the foundations for it. And I read everything in from, you know, Christ's time to roughly 300 AD, all the fathers, the councils, not only Christian, but Jewish and pagan too. And because I read very quickly, and because I already had a foundation in Plato and Aristotle, I was in a perfect position to do this. And Nebraska, of course, has a gigantic library. And there, of course, these men don't use terms like faith and reason the same way moderns do, or postmoderns do. Let's put it like this. Faith is defined as a proper use of freedom. In fact, the very existence of freedom presupposes reason. Truth is a matter of intellect, but faith is a matter of will. So when I say that truth doesn't give you reason to follow it, this is what I mean. Terms like faith has been, you know, these have been redefined because something can be true, but if we don't want to follow it, we won't. Now, certain personalities like mine are forced to, unfortunately. We don't have to accept the truth of the church or of anyone for that matter. Normally, those rejecting the faith, the Orthodox faith today, either, and overwhelmingly, they simply don't understand it. You know, in other words, they've been given a very poor education in it. They've read very little. They know a few slogans and that they don't like, and that's it. Or, more commonly, they have a non-intellectual reason for rejecting it. The fact that very few apologists exist today, doesn't help matter. So what I tried to say last week, that scripture takes a sophisticated epistemological view in the context we're talking about, where truth is known to the consequence of an object's action. Reason is not the same as a science, because all doctrine has to be laid out in some logical form, and that requires an additional entity, and it requires a foundation. No, reason is the very structure of God's creation. It's the aim of theology. It's not its method. This is what we mean by logos. It is the ground of reality. It's the reason that any proof of anything can be found at all. Wisdom is a synonym in the Old Testament sense. It revolves around the will of God shown in experience. The will of God is in actions that lead to our thriving, spiritually speaking. Falsehood is that which destroys. For God's people, and of course we are Israel in the Orthodox faith, everything that occurs exists for some purpose. Theology is social, and that God has created human nature as well as other natures, and each contains a law that dictates its own end or purpose. Humans are social beings. Everything that we are is non-individual. To act in accordance with this nature is the same as to act reasonably, because in following our nature would be following God's design. That's reason in the true sense. So faith is the will to act accordingly and to resist self-interest. In other words, the concept of faith is connected to will. It's what happens when you find the truth, the ability to deny yourself, to deny the world, to deny consequences, and follow it, which unfortunately we know is very, very few. MC Albel asked the question, is resurrection reasonable? And he quickly clarifies this broad question by asking whether it's reasonable to believe that God intervened in the natural order. Now, of course, as always, the problem is how he frames the question. The concept of reasonable in a question like this is ambiguous. Another secular bias is the term logical is often used as identical to the scientific. So to answer his question, there's no contradiction in believing in the resurrection, but it is arbitrary to believe the opposite. There's no prima facie reason why such a view would be unreasonable. So really such an answer isn't saying very much. On the other hand, it's very unreasonable to say that nothing exists, all is void, because the act of stating the question is its very refutation. If there's no unchanging foundation, then the void is all that there is. It's unreasonable to claim, for example, that reason is not a reliable path to truth. To deny reason is a contradiction, because the speaker, when you make a remark like that, now has to defend it using reason. There would have to be some order in the person's thoughts so that an audience, whoever he's communicating this to, can be convinced that this very same reason will not normally lead to truth. It's unreasonable because it contains a contradiction. Any doctrine of any kind must have some rational core to be expressed. So speaking of the role of reason in faith is redundant. The very exposition of doctrine implies it. If it doesn't, then you have to use reason to explain why. At no time in church history were monastics and humanists different people. It's a very, very common false dichotomy, the same Athens-Jerusalem nonsense. And it's a similar error, just applied in different contexts. Throughout the Middle Ages, the so-called humanists and the so-called monastics read the same books and they believed in the same doctrine. The problem with reading modern medievalists is that, they're not medievalists, they're historians and universities writing on medieval topics. They're academics who are usually atheists, they're usually urban, and unfamiliar with any kind of religious truth or lifestyle. Reason was never opposed to anything. Logos was the very reason of the world. To the prejudice that reason is something that's a faculty, like logic, has to be removed. Reason is something that's present everywhere. We discover it, we uncover it, we unveil it. We don't invent it. The scriptures see this sort of rational core as wisdom in the Old Testament. reason is never separated from divinity, social life, or ethical action. Knowledge is only truly so when it points to something intrinsic to the created order like human nature. So in the book of Proverbs, chapter 3, we read this. By wisdom the Lord laid the earth's foundation. By understanding he set the heavens in place. By his knowledge the watery depths were divided, and the clouds let drop the dew. Verses 19-20. By understanding, he set the heavens in place. By his knowledge, the watery depths. That's an odd way to put it, because in our debased English, that doesn't make any sense. And that concept, by the way, is repeated over and over again. What I tried to get across last week and many other times is that even something, you know, that foundational is known by very few. And it doesn't make any sense to most people, including educated people. Knowledge is not what the majority claim or what is fashionable, but what is endured regardless of all of this. There are laws that adhere to the human person as such. You know, modernity loves to pat itself on the back and say that we are dedicated to scientific rigor and logical exactitude, and look at the technology that's come from this. And yet the minute you start talking about how that should be used, all of a sudden everything's relative and foggy. Isn't that odd? Everything but actual human nature itself is subject to scientific analysis. And there's good reason for this. As I've said many times before, you know, Darwin was music to the ears of the British colonialists and industrialists in the middle of the 19th century. Not only were their behaviors okay, but in accordance with nature. They didn't have to feel guilty anymore about destroying their competition or absorbing another territory. But regardless of that, there are laws that are manifest in human nature itself. Simple ones. I mean, those working hard are more valuable than those who steal. Right? It's a simple axiom, and no one could deny it. A society that stresses hard work versus one that stresses theft is going to do much better. See, a society based on theft can't function. In a society like that, the results of your own work are always insecure. Now, you don't need Immanuel Kant to reach that. That's understood long before him. Those who are honest are more valuable than those who are not. How can a society of liars function? If you had no idea what people around you were saying, if it was true or false, then all communication would be futile. You see, the point is, just like the example above, it's a contradiction. To deny those axioms, these laws of human nature, is to violate the possibility of any social order at all. And so they have to be part of the human nature. And to deny them is falsehood. To deny them is living death. They're not just wrong in the sense of being incorrect, but they fundamentally violate the human need for community. We're not individuals. They violate our need for language and thought, which is, you know, concomitant to community. And nothing I've said in this last few sentences, these aren't opinions. There's no way to deny it. Now, industrialization created this bizarre abstract concept of the individual. And if you're going to break down resistance to a revolution, then the best thing you could do is break down the foundations for any kind of concerted action. The individual by himself is pretty useless. and certainly without the knowledge that many generations have accumulated. You know, language, customs, warnings, aphorisms, turns of phrase, denotations, connotations, stories, in a healthy society, these aren't arbitrary verbiage. But those are the very conditions of thinking. Now, of course, I exclude the postmodern West, postmodern America, because there is no culture. It is an acultural void. It is a bizarre, Kabbalistic experiment. But in every other society, that holds true. I mean, you know, the postmodern world is an anomaly. But falsity is that which both justifies the rule of the lower appetites over the soul, as well as their social consequences. So as I've said elsewhere, to permit the free reign of male lust is to court absolute disaster. And that's not a matter of, it's not my personal opinion. You can't promote the sexual revolution on the one hand and then complain that women are turned into objects on the other. That consequence is inherent in that very passion. So it's no accident that all societies, to be societies at all have some very harsh precautions to control this powerful drive. It's an objective reality, and only force really can deny it for a short time. Again, these aren't personal opinions. It's just how it is. So when passion is unhinged from its ancient warnings and prohibitions, in that sense, for example, women have good reason to fear. So this is wisdom manifest, embodied reason that can't be reduced to formal logic. Reason doesn't illumine theology, it's manifest in it. Reason is an ontological category. It is not necessarily an epistemological one. And even today, modern academics really don't even have the vocabulary to express this. The bias is so bad. So in this respect, St. Maximus the Confessor says, he's talking about the golden calf in the Old Testament. And he says this: "Thus, if the intellect is able to view the sensible object in itself, apart from its relationship to the sense faculty, and the sense faculty in itself, apart from its connection with the sensible object, and the natural power, desire, for example, apart from its impassioned alliance with the sense faculty and the sensible object, the intellect, in so doing, grinds to powder the constitution of the calf, that is, of whatever passion, and scatters it upon the water of knowledge. The intellect has then made even the slightest imagination of passions completely to vanish by restoring each of its elements to its natural state. Maybe to grind to powder the molten calf of our soul and make it vanish, so our souls may have in them the image of the divine, unadulterated, and unblemished by any external thing whatsoever." Now that argument, that statement, really can summarize the entire patristic corpus on reason. Now what he means is that the object's natural state is its archetype or nature. When an object, you know, a physical thing, is perceived by the senses, the unnatural, the disordered soul seeks to dominate it and consume it as an individual thing. It only sees external qualities, and usually only of some of them. It wants private property in the object, so as to exclude all others from its enjoyment. That's the root of the golden calf. That's reversion to post-lapsarian life, paganism, so to speak. The natural, the normal state of the soul is when these perceptions are not immediately connected to this desire. So when the object is connected to its archetype, to what it actually is, that's knowledge. It's dispassionate apprehension, not desire, dominating both the will and the intellect. What it really comes down to is that it's to perceive wisdom or reason in the object itself. The perception of an object can go one of two ways. First, the sinful way, that of domination or control over the thing. You see this in Hegel, in the master-slave dialectic. You see it in Sartre, in the existentialist. The sinful way is to remove the object from its connection to anything else, to refuse to see its archetype and see it only as exemplifying certain qualities. That's the ideology of possessive individualism. The other way is that the object, rather than provoking desire, provokes reason, which is, of course, the correspondence of the object to its form. When that happens, the divine energy is apprehended and logos is perceived. This, of course, is the distinction between essence and accident, which is a scholastic distinction which is very important. The essence of the thing, which is what a thing actually is. And the accident, in certain ways that it presents itself. Right? What color hair you have has nothing to do with human nature. So the accidents, or the qualities, deal with the nominal, the properties of the object. But the intellect is form. That's the connection of reason and faith. These are one and the same. It is not just the apprehension, but also the will. But epistemology has a strongly ontological connection for this very reason. So again, St. Maximus the Confessor says this: "We too must first be lifted up to God, and having steeled the soul, extend its whole desire to Him, and then accordingly descend to search after beings and regard each one in terms of its own nature, and through them again be drawn up by completeness of knowledge to the Creator. Such a person gathers the winds in his bosom, for he gathers into the bosom of his own heart the diverse logoi of beings, which are named figuratively as clouds. Consequently, one ought to realize that in gathering the diverse logoi in the productive and contemplative part of the heart, one brings to birth the one word of God, for many logoi of beings are gathered into one." Now, the clouds comment is he's talking about a Bible passage here. But again, these two quotes from Maximus the Confessor show the deeply Platonic nature of Christian thought, and explains in some detail the nature of reason. Now, remember, the forms, and when I say, I mean Plato's forms, are created things. And they are gathered into logos, which is uncreated. Now that concept, that very concept makes a mockery of the division between Athens and Jerusalem, or faith and reason. It's a stupid metaphor, it's a non-existent distinction. The logoi, which is plural for logos or form. The logoi of a thing is that which the logos or Christ used to create the world. Plato's forms have always been understood, both East and West, as the tools by which Christ manifests the power of the Father in the world. They're created by the Father, the origin of everything. And this is really nothing but the personalization of the One, which you could read about in Plotinus. The One is a person, though. This is something that Plotinus and the Platonists never quite grasped. The One is a person, it's not an abstraction. Now, a metaphysician can't really talk about persons. A mathematician like Plato or Spinoza can't talk about individual personalities. Why the One, or the Father, would contain everything but a personality is something no modern can ever answer. An object is scientific in our world only to the extent that it doesn't have a personality. When something is given a personality, it becomes a myth. It's a very bizarre thing, but it's absolutely true. And you could talk about autonomous ideas in the human mind, But the minute you use a word like demon or an angel and give them a certain personality and agenda, all of a sudden you're crazy. But up until that point, everything's okay. So thousands of university seminars on faith and reason prove the utter incompetence of these people. I'll say it again. Faith has never meant, in the history of the church, the blind adherence to doctrine. If anything, university professors are guilty of this, because they hold the liberal ideology without evidence. There's no real difference except it comes from philosophers rather than sacred texts. University professors have absolutely no choice but to believe the axioms of far-left liberalism, which gets worse on campus every day. And it doesn't matter whether there's evidence or not, they have a great job and an easy job. They don't work very hard. They talk about what they know or what they think they know. They have access to lots of young females. They have tons interns and grad students doing most of their work for them. Undergraduates are writing papers on areas that they want to talk about and could easily be used by them. They have secretaries, big salary, a lot of prestige in that job, and of course, 100% job security. That is to say, job security so long as you support the agenda. That's the American university professor. And if you're a white male, and you have one of these jobs that are getting more and more scarce as time goes on, you will do anything to maintain them. And so the most radical people on university campuses usually are white males, and it comes from fear. But the distinction between Athens and Jerusalem, which is, you know, you hear this in every freshman seminar, or faith and reason, which is, you know, the other way to put it. There's no difference between them because one can be expressed in terms of the other. Take a philosophy course in American university, they will deliberately leave out the patristic era. Only, well, St. Augustine is the one exception, which shows you how arbitrary the canon is of academic philosophy. You have philosophers of the absolute first rank that are excluded. Justin, Athanasius, Maximus, Simeon, Gregory, all metaphysicians of the first rank. But they're deliberately ignored because they show that philosophy and religion are identical, except in the mode of its transmission or expression. So if you reduce faith to a non-philosophical or even non-rational acceptance of doctrine, is to be dishonest. It's a dishonest caricature. The two quotes that I cited from St. Maximus above a few minutes ago show the forms of Plato are granted their ultimate resting place in Christ. Remember, Christ claimed not to have the truth, but to be the truth. Only God could say that. This is an explicit mention, as in Old Testament wisdom, of the Logos doctrine, and that the forms created by God are the archetypes of creation and rest in the expression of the Creator. Christ is Logos and its production, creation itself. They're an orderly descent from the one to the many. Sin is what cuts us off from our origin. When you have a society, and this is 2019 America, that functions entirely as a factory for sin and passions in the worst way, living death becomes the norm. You know, a passion doesn't mean enthusiasm. It means something like hatred or lust or greed or something like that. These all lead to disaster. They're sins because they're wrong. They're sins that bear the seeds of their own punishment. Remember, sins aren't these oppressive prohibitions from this stern God. This isn't rule following. But they're manifest in the very structure of the world. The glutton who wants to eat and drink anything he pleases at any time will soon realize the rationality of the limits that society places on food consumption. But they're reasonable because they correspond to the design of the human form. And these are not dependent on the glutton's will. All societies have had some kind of periodic fasting, which exists for, among other reasons, to promote health in accordance with these very same limits. Again, not matters of opinion. Just one more axiom that's a part of human nature and natural law. You can't deny it. So in Proverbs 12, it says, "Those who work their land will have abundant food, but those who chase fantasies have no sense." Now, this simple example states that to be disciplined and focused on a task is what society needs to function. That's how socially necessary labor is accomplished. Fantasy is false, and that is destructive. It's irrational, it's unwise. Any society that stresses a kind of egotistical disdain for labor will suffer. While, of course, a disciplined society will have everything it needs. So again, the next chapter, Proverbs 13. Whoever disregards discipline comes to poverty and shame. Whoever heeds correction is honored. In other words, this is actual knowledge as a manifestation of reason. Professor Albel summarizes it this way. What is the ultimate source of the moral law? Lewis shows that individual societies not simply have invented it, or else how could one explain why basic ethical standards of the ancient Egyptians, ancient Chinese, medieval Europeans, or modern Americans, all cultures that have no contact with one another, are essentially the same? Now, I have to laugh when he says modern Americans, but I guess to some extent it is true. I mean, there is still a revulsion to things like extreme obesity, gluttony, cowardice, lying. The society happens to be built on these things. But society is also built on cognitive dissonance. Still, the point remains. Basic ethical standards have remained identical no matter where you go. In grad school, I read E. Michael Jones's critique, one of the greatest books I've ever read, was Degenerate Moderns by E. Michael Jones. It's one of these books that changed my life. And one of the most potent, I can almost quote it from memory, it made such an impression on me, was the analysis of Margaret Mead. When she goes to the 20s, in the South Pacific, to Samoa, American Samoa, and she had an agenda. Her agenda was to show that non-Christian societies don't have any strong prohibitions on sexual activity. They can pretty much do what they want. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. But she didn't know the language. She didn't actually talk to anyone on the island. There had been a giant hurricane by the time she got there. Everything was in chaos. That wasn't the point. Everybody else that studied the Samoans says, no, Margaret Mead is absolutely wrong. Hunter-gatherer societies, I don't care how primitive you get, are identical. Men are the hunters and the protectors. Women are to be protected. Male lust is something recognized as extremely dangerous. The family is protected, usually on pain of death. And in Samoa, adultery is punishable by death, like in most ancient societies. In other words, she just lied, and it became the foundation of anthropology. being a student of Boaz and that whole school of corruption. Anthropology is a completely phony field. I mean, I actually taught a class, Intro to Anthropology, before. And at the end of it, I said, I can't figure out how this field differs from everything I do every day as a historian. Well, the difference is ideology. The difference is people like Margaret Mead and Franz Boas were founding this and creating it. The source of the law is built in human nature. This is the connection between rational thought and God, the creator. If truth, you know, fundamental truths are eternal, then so must the source be. Remember, theology doesn't use reason, it discerns it. And the point of all this is to show that faith is not credulity. Blind faith is a different story. Faith is the idea that knowledge is grounded in human nature, and that this nature did not and could not create itself. The absurdity of this postmodern self-creation, that's the very zenith of blind faith. The fact that laws clearly adhere to the human body, to social life, the natural order, suggests this isn't a random collection of experiences. The proper use of the term faith is that since these self-enforcing limits are essential for even basic human functioning, as we've been talking about, they're not accidental. Therefore, they speak to a powerful spiritual being discerned through these clear laws. The very existence of lawfulness in the natural order implies that the Creator exists and is communicating with man. Laws can't evolve or develop, nor are they separate from the matter they govern, yet they're different from matter. And keep in mind, science has no right to discuss the origin, the nature of these laws. They can discuss how they're manifest in physical form. But if it's not basic cause and effect, they need to shut up. Often you get two extremes. In these discussions, you know, the first, of course, is unquestioning obedience to authority, blind faith, that has no critical foundation. And the second is the opposite, the rejection of all authority and the presumed dedication to the person's own private store of knowledge. Often in discussions here, people will be dishonest, and any reference to reason will be attacked by some claim to authority. Any attack on authority will be attacked on some foundation of reason. But those are extreme types. What's more controversial is why those reasons are such extremes are problematic. I mean, the first, those who just follow authority, and every society needs those people, it's easy for them to permit others to think for them. Because having someone else think for you gets you out of a lot of very difficult work. Not to mention, you avoid all responsibility. And even better, people who are credulous, the ordinary person absorbed in the daily grind of an increasingly irrational life really has no grounds to base an opinion. Now, of course, if society's healthy, this isn't a problem. Today, it's not. To conform to American society is to accept, you know, fat acceptance and transsexual mental illness and to hate the family and hate white people. I mean, this is to conform to modern America. That's the prejudice that's ingrained in kids growing up today. But on the other hand, pure empiricism doesn't work either. It's completely irrational because it needs a foundation. It has to connect our experiences to logic and logic to reason. But pure empiricism can't provide this. Empiricism is you know, to observe things in the external world for some purpose and to search for patterns. But that already says a mouthful, that you're assuming that patterns exist and that you can discern them. There has to be a third entity. There has to be a context and an order. The Russians always called it the intuition of the whole that holds it all together. But pure empiricism can't provide this. The distinction between rationalism and empiricism is also false. Because even if anyone bothers to read the early Enlightenment writers that on both sides of that debate, they don't deny each other. People just like making these false dichotomies. It makes it easier to categorize people. But of course, all empiricists accept some concept of a foundation, which is really taken for granted in the society at the time. And all rationalists, of course, don't ignore observation. That would be ridiculous. So again, you come across these freshman college seminar BS distinctions, and you realize that they have no merit. Empiricism implies rationalism and vice versa. Faith implies reason and vice versa. It's just easier for people to avoid the work of actually reading anybody and using these ridiculous conceptual distinctions to make them, you know, sound intelligent, I guess. So St. Gregory of Palamas writes this, and he's talking about the union, the identity of faith and reason. What man of reason, who sees the evident differences between the essences of things, both the oppositions of their powers and the compensating origins of their motions, their incessant successions from contrary properties, and the unmingled attraction from inconceivable strife, the conjunctions of separate and unmixable things, and a unity which are spirit, souls, bodies, this harmony of things so numerous, this stability in their relations and positions, this conformity of states and orders to their essence, the indissolubility of their cohesion, what man, taking all this into his mind, would not think of who had positioned everything so well in its place and established this admirable harmony of all things and recognized God in his image and in the beings which derive their origin from him. Orthodoxy is Platonic, regardless of some of the nonsense from John Roman Dedis and his followers. Orthodoxy is Platonic, science is Platonic, because without forms, experience really turns out to be arbitrary and even bizarre. Strength alone rules. Now, faith that comes from this can be found everywhere. So you have people, for example, who believe in stupid things like karma. They're going to defeat the wrongdoers because they are powerless. The belief that things that one perceives are actually out there. The belief that people are rationally, people that are rational and good. That ridiculous belief. That one should follow their self-interest. They're built into the anti-culture that we live in. And these are very common assumptions, accepted without question. Now, I guess it might be because accepting these is easier than the alternative, but mostly because people don't have the immense store of theoretical and empirical knowledge one would need to even begin to offer an opinion on these topics. So whether you want to accept it or not, the most extreme credulity and blind faith, not only everywhere, but might be even absolutely necessary for any society to function, especially this one. A corrupt society needs more lies. It needs more credulity. As I've said a million times, everything that the average educated American believes is mythical. It's all blind faith. He believes what he's told. But how faith operates in 2019 leads to very different things than when faith existed in 1119. So the other extreme, of course, is reject all authority except your own. Now, this is more common. It's admitted far more often. But it already contains a contradiction, because to believe this is to follow another's doctrine, since the person who says this didn't invent it. To believe that I will accept no authority but my own means that you've invented the idea that you're going to follow no authority except your own. To reject all authority is far more problematic, because logic, language, social meaning, symbolism, information, sources of information, social priorities, education, and the daily interaction that makes it all possible are not the creation of such a deluded man. In fact, the empirical anarchy is not the creation of the anarchist, nor are the issues that make one so radical in the first place. So if you go around saying that, you know, you will follow no other authority but your own, that comes from an authority or a tradition. By definition, you can't become an anarchist by reading about the doctrine in a book. That doesn't make any sense. The New Testament book of Jude doesn't get cited very often because it's so brief. But he's speaking of Sodom and Gomorrah, and he says this: "These ungodly people pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and heap abuse on celestial beings. Yet these people slander whatever they do not understand. And the very things they understand by instinct, as irrational animals do, will destroy them. But dear friends, remember what the apostles of the Lord Jesus Christ foretold. They said to you, in the last times there will be scoffers who will follow their own ungodly desires. These are the people who divide you, who follow mere natural instincts and do not have the Spirit." This is precisely what I've been talking about for the last hour. This means that which is instinctive for subconscious, the passions and drives, without rational control, lead not only to falsehood, of course, but personal and social destruction. Jude is talking about the second extreme of epistemological nihilism. It's the root to both evil and falsity. See, those who scoff do so not because they're proudly independent, usually because they can't bear any restrictions on their ungodly desires. People calling themselves skeptics usually mean they're just skeptics of Christianity, and they accept the myths of society with utter blind credulity. The very discipline that Proverbs makes the center of achieving true wisdom really is too much for anyone who just seeks gratification. They deny whatever does not flatter their lusts. The satisfaction of lust is, regardless, temporary anyway, and negative consequences show themselves very, very soon. But when you have a society completely dedicated to it, and billions, trillions of profits being made every year on it, you have the medical profession doing everything in its power to, psychology, ideology, doing everything in its power to delay or solve the problems of what happens when you press against the limits of natural law. Reason is not an autonomous tool that theology can use to illumine the truth. Reason's never autonomous, since if it were, there'd be no reason to follow it. It's manifest in our human nature. When you talk about nature, you also include our own human nature. something that moderns always leave out. Reason is manifest in creation. Not only does logic tell us this and science tell us this, but both the New and Old Testaments, says this. Whether it be wisdom, grace, logos, truth, whatever word is used, it's one and the same presence of God's power in creation. Truth is to discern this reality. And of course, this is the point of all legitimate science. Reason is the very core of theology. It's the structure of the Christian faith. The modern world, without exception, is based on rejecting this simple truth. The Enlightenment and its apogee, its zenith and industrialization, cannot stand such limitations. And of course, humanity is already feeling the consequences. That the world is merely the random interaction of atoms and the energy that they represent, or the energy itself, then any power in society, the state, and in our case, corporate capital, can use any means at its disposal to dominate and control resources, human or otherwise. If, on the other hand, nature is a direct creation of logos, is a manifestation of logos, and grace is a permanent presence in the very constitution of the world, then these same elites have a highly limited spectrum of options. Moral order is built into the very construction of the natural order, which includes themselves. Heresy, then, seen in this light, becomes the very foundation of falsehood. Heresy is accomplished through the process of isolating one text or idea from its context, usually with bad intention. As I've said before, nominalism doesn't recognize context, because the context is, in fact, a universal. So societies based on its assumptions have a tendency to isolate phenomenon from its broader base. In other words, they see phenomenon as just that, just an image. And this is the curse of modernity. Political and economic elites, scriptures, the church, humanity, the natural order, sex, the family, they're all seen as separate and isolated things. And they're isolated from each other because nominalism doesn't see community and relation as an ontological category, which of course they are. Heresy, falsehood, and death draws from nominalism because there is no ontologically constituted community. In fact, there's no ontologically constituted anything. So context is an arbitrary random arrangement of objects. Like I tried to get across last week, and it's hard to do. The Protestants, which are the ultimate destroyers, I mean, they destroyed European civilization. Not necessarily, you know, Luther and the Anglicans. The Anglicans certainly did nothing wrong, but Luther's successors certainly did. The Protestants see no ontological, that is to say, logical problem by taking the Bible out of its ancient context and using it against the church. The church that put it together. It's one of the points I made last week. In Orthodoxy, the same inconsistency occurs when bishops or the fathers, quote unquote, are taken out of their own context and seen as authorities in their own right. I tell you, the only reason people read the fathers anymore is to get ammunition to use against their enemies. Heresies, falsehood. I mean, in history, the first millennium of Christianity, heresy is a political view. It seeks to increase the power of the state at the expense of the spirit. So once Luther kicks the church out of parts of Germany, the state took over. Very soon, the massive increase in elite wealth that came from plundering the churches created a land market, an entirely new source of wealth for state and private elites. Nothing was ever the same again. I said last week, to remove the specific will from Christ's human nature, for example, is to remove the theological basis for any human autonomy. The whole monophysite issue is essential. Whether human nature is swallowed up in the divine or absorbed into matter, heresy has this tendency. It's the imprisoning of human nature. And Luther wasn't the creator of the secularization, but he only increased its appetite. Grace ceased being a part of of nature in the Church of Rome, as it was absorbed by the single and solitary papal office. And soon the Medici banking house bought the papacy during the Renaissance. And the usury charged by the papal and Medici bankers and money changers was part of the reason for Luther's outrage in the first place. And you can't really blame him for that. You also can't blame him for the fact that Orthodoxy was in terrible shape at the time, and the Turks would not permit any connection between him and the Greeks. Anyway, I hope that this has clarified a bit of what I tried to do last week. This is such a gigantic topic, and it really comes from a lot of people asking me, how do you develop the mindset to break out of modernity? We debate these people. It's always done on their turf, with their words, their language, and their assumptions. How do you break out of it? How do you think like a medieval? Because if you think like a modern, even though you reject it, you're always the visiting team. You never have the home field advantage. This is the very beginning of a way. I mean, the rejection of nominalism is the first step without doubt. What nominalism is, and its connection with modernity, its connection with the Kabbalah, its connection to the Protestant Reformation. I did a whole broadcast on the connection between the Kabbalah and the Reformation. Again, I wasn't referring to Luther personally or the Anglicans to a great extent, but their successors most certainly. This was a revolutionary movement. Nominalism is a bizarre anomaly. It really doesn't make any sense unless you have a powerful faction in society that wants to hear it. Now, it's certainly the case for Darwin. The fact that Darwinian evolution could have survived the discovery of DNA, which of course makes a mockery of the theory, proves that it's really just power. And to recognize the distinction between power and authority is another step. But this is just the beginning. What you have to do to break out of the modern, postmodern mentality, the manipulation of language, I began thinking like a normal human being. That is to say, a medieval or a man in classical Greece or Rome. That's what a normal European would, how they would think. We live in a bizarre zoo experiment with absolutely no precedent in human history. Anyway, thank you everyone for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.